Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Phil Tiger. Slacker
Podcast. Slacker Podcast. Hello, Slackers. Hello, Slackers. Here I am at Camp Granada. Bit of a Simpsons reference there for anybody listening to the Slacker Podcast this week. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I hope you're all good. To all of the Slackers who've been listening to this podcast for a while, hello to you. It's good to have you back with us, and anybody who's fresh to the podcast with our guest today, Connor Oberst, then the podcast is probably guaranteed to be the best podcast you've ever heard in your whole life. And if you don't feel that way at the end, then send Acast a bill for £1 million. Okay, please don't do that. Yes, the Slacker Podcast is a music-specific podcast where we get some of the best artists from around the world, generally in alternative music, sometimes in the pop sphere, sometimes in the rap sphere. And we just chat to them about their early days, the war stories, the early demos, their views on life. It's just it's a podcast. And you've got myself, Phil Taggart, who is a card-carrying music nerd. Big up to the Patreons who are subscribing at patreon.com/slackerpodcast. Everybody who's liking and reviewing the podcast on the Apple charts or wherever it is that you listen to your podcast. I haven't reached out and done that for a while. I think I might have mentioned it a little bit last week, but I haven't really done it this series. But after I did last week, I think it absolutely rocketed up the charts because people went and did it. So if you have been listening to loads of these and you want to sort of pay me back something, go and do that. That would be very, very helpful. This week's podcast is with an artist who I have a very deep affection for. His name is Connor Oberst. I'm a big fan of Bright Eyes. I'm probably a bigger fan of his own solo stuff. And I just generally think that he is the second coming. There, I said it. And his relationship that recently with Phoebe Bridgerton, a creative relationship, has been great to see as well. I've been a big fan of Connor's music for some time. He's one of those artists that has pulled me out of tough times. You know, just lyrically and musically, just everything sort of seemed to hit home with me at a specific time. So I thank him deeply for that, and it was very good to sit down and chat to him back in August about this demo. This demo is really going back as well. His voice hasn't even broken it. So I'm going to spare no more time, and we're going to jump into it. This is a Slacker Podcast with Connor Oberst in 3, 2, 1. Joining me on the Slacker Podcast tonight, we have got Connor Oberst. Hello.
Hello, Philip. It's nice to be with you.
It is nice to have you on as well. It is nice to talk to you after all these years. Where you like at the other end of the headphones, I've kind of always felt like I've had a friend or a kindred spirit, having listened to your music for such a long time. Now, when I'm coming to speak to you, I really hope you don't ruin it for me. I hope you're not a real asshole.
Well, I am kind of an asshole. So, but I'll try my best behavior.
same, we can try together. It'll be funny. So how's things? How are you doing as we record this mid-August?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. You know, I spent I guess the first 5 months or so of the you know, kind of quarantine lockdown pandemic situation in Los Angeles. So I have a house in Los Angeles, and I have a house here in Omaha, Nebraska, where I am right now. So, yeah, the first 5 months, it was just, you know, I mean, literally, like, me and my girlfriend in our house doing, you know, nothing, not, like, leaving. Like, I mean, I guess we would go to the grocery store, but it was very much a strict lockdown situation. And then, I guess in July, I drove back here to Omaha just to kind of check in with my family and I got some dogs here that'll probably make some noise.
That's good.
They're misbehaving.
I've got a dog on the side too. We can make them like fight over the internet.
And you know, here it's like a little, I don't know. It's, you know, of course, I'm sure you guys are reading all about it, but you know, I mean, we have such a failure of, you know, obviously like leadership or any kind of plan for this thing. So you go state to state. I mean, I remember being kind of shocked when I got back here to Nebraska, just how it almost seemed like it wasn't going on. It's like people were still hanging out. And like, it was shocking to me, having been in LA for so long, where everyone's like masked up and it's like super serious and everything's closed. Then you get here and it's like, if you drive down the street, it's like people falling out of bars and like, it's like it's never happened, you know? So it's kind of, and we have a real shithead of a governor here in Nebraska that doesn't know anything. But, and then I leave California, and after 5 months of doing all this, you know, what I thought was pretty dedicated work, that everyone was, you know, adhering to all the rules, they kind of lessened, you know, they let up for like a month, and now their numbers are like way back up. It's like almost like it's back up to where it was in March. So it's just, I don't know. I mean, not to just talk about the pandemic, but
yeah, it's I mean, it's hard not to. Like, I live in Brighton, like south coast of the UK, and like a lot of my friends play in bands, and like the bands are normally like on tour, or they're probably doing festivals around the stage. And the sort of commonality like that they had between them in the conversations I was having with them was, this isn't really much different than real life. Like, as in, like when they're on tour, you know, your ass never touches the ground. Like you're just going from one place to the other. But specifically my friend Joe, he was just like, I just sit in the house and write songs when I'm not on tour. Like, I very rarely see people anyway. So like, this isn't that difficult.
Yeah, I think some people are, you know, obviously some people are dealing with it better than others. You know, I've found like in my world, like there's kind of like two camps. The one camp, you know, and you know, like yours, I'm sure like most of my friends are artists and musicians, and you know, well, that's actually not true. I have tons of friends that work in like the restaurant and bar businesses, and they're just unemployed and wait, you know, like just on the dole, like they gotta wait for their check, and it's like a nightmare. But anyway, amongst the artists and musician types, you know, I feel like there's two camps. There's the one camp that's taking this time to kind of like self-improve and write songs or do stuff around the house that you've been putting off for years, or you know, just like using their time like in a productive way.
And then
there's like the other camp, which I've fallen into, which is like have had no motivation and you know, just have basically just fallen into kind of just malaise, despair, or like, I don't know. I like try to go on walks, try to like hang out like with the few people I can hang out with. But, you know, honestly, it's like, it's just every day is the same and you can't really, you know,
can't really
go anywhere.
Shit up that much. When I had your friend Phoebe on the podcast, she said that she'd started drinking just for something to do. She doesn't even drink.
I know. Yeah. I can attest to that. She very much does not drink. She's kind of a lightweight, but she's probably tipped a few back. You know, so yeah, I think people are doing crazy stuff and I think people are acting weird. I mean, I don't know. I'm just kind of like, I've just been feeling like, what's the point? You know, like I like look at my guitars and like I look at my piano and I'm like, I could be absolutely writing songs right now, but I just...
It's hard to get motivated. It's hard to get inspired. But the thing is, like, what's going on in your front room and what's going on the sort of face of things are two completely different things. Because, like, if you're like me or just a fan of your music, on the face of things, it looks like you've never been busier because you've got Bright Eyes record out and you're like, you know, doing like releasing tracks. Like Mariana Trench just came out. So, like, you know, in the public facing thing, everybody's like, oh, wow, like, you know, Bright Eyes back, Connor's back at it, amazing. But the reality of it is like you're probably playing ball in a cup in your front room. You're like,
yeah, totally.
Ball in that cup.
I mean, yeah, we, you know, as you know, whatever they say about all the best laid plans or whatever, but you know, we were all set to go, you know, I mean, just like everybody, it's not even worth complaining about, but you know, we were probably 2 weeks out from going to Japan was the first show. Actually, Phoebe was, we were going to go to Japan together and like go on like this like fun, like it's like vacation. It was going to be like really sweet. And then like, we were going to play our first show, like, you know, this like the first Bright Eyes show. And we had like all these Japanese musicians lined up and it was like exciting. Wow. Oh my and, God. It was like about 2 weeks out that they, you know, it was like, you can't go to Japan. And then we were like, okay, well, you know, at that point, so this is early March. We're like, okay, well, maybe it's just like an Asia thing. Maybe it's like, it'll still be cool to do all the other stuff we had planned. And then that all kind of got dusted. And so, yeah, I mean, what was this like grand, you know, probably almost 2 year plan that we had made, you know, for like a year before it, after making the record, kind of all got swept away. And then, I don't know, you're just left with this like, this weird, like, what do I, you know, I mean, I guess fingers crossed, like maybe next summer or something we can like do shows again, but like, you know, I'm just left with this sort of like void of a year that was, there was so much stuff planned. And now it's like, I mean, obviously we've been trying to promote the record as best as we can, you know, doing interviews and doing little video stuff or whatever, but you know, it's not the same as like
live stream, a rock and roll tour. Live stream. Yeah. Yeah, exactly, man. Live streams just don't come back at you. In that same way, but the way that you move from project to project over the years means that like this is going to be like like it's going to be like three buses arriving at once. Like next year you'll probably have like a Bright Eyes record, a solo record, like a poker record, a drum and bass record, and a hip-hop record all dropping in 2020.
Hopefully
you get that motivation back first, I suppose. The demo that we have to start the podcast, if anybody is fresh into the Slacker podcast and is coming here to hear from Connor, this podcast plays demos from some of the greatest musicians there are going. I suggest you go back and listen to maybe Johnny Marr playing a version of Gene. I don't even know what to, yeah, the Phoebe Bridgers did one of Motion Sickness a couple of months ago as well, which is pretty sick. And today we've got one that I didn't even know existed, which is really cool. And the whole point of this thing is a demo of I don't know what age you are. You can tell me, but it's a demo of Commander Venus, which was your band. And do you feel at home?
Yeah. So it's not even a demo. It's like an actually released album. But I started writing songs when I was about 12 years old, and I put out a couple cassette tapes under my own name. One was called Water, and one was called Here's a Special Treatment. And, you know, recorded them 4-track, sold them for $3 at the one cool record store in town. I had just started playing shows. You know, this is like, you know, that was 93. That was my first, you know, just entry into music. And luckily there was a pretty supportive music scene, you know, older people around town that were, you know, I think at first I was basically like a novelty act, because I was just a little kid that got up on stage with my acoustic guitar and screamed, and people reacted to that. But there's you know, there was some older people in Omaha, like this guy Simon Joyner, who's a really great songwriter, who was a big inspiration to me. And then the guys like Tim Kasher, who went on to be to do Cursive and to do Good Life and all these other bands. You know, he was old, you know, he was about 5 years older than me. My old
18.
Yeah. You know, yeah, exactly. My oldest brother Maddie played in bands. This guy named Ted Stevens, who was in Mike Mogus's first band called Lullaby for the Working Class, he was actually the first guy to like come over and record my first album, I guess, cassette album. But anyway, when I was 14, I guess, 14, Tim Kasher, who was like basically my hero, and he was in a band called Slow Down Virginia at the time before he formed Cursive, but I was kind of, you know, I was obsessed with him. I thought he was the greatest. And he decided to start a band with me. And so when I was 14, yeah, he's probably like 18. We started this band called Commander Venus. It was at first it was just the three of us, us and this guy Matt Bowen, who's a drummer. We were a three piece. We made a record called Do You Feel at Home, which is, this is the title track. And I guess long story short, it was like an early Saddle Creek release. I don't know what number it was, but you know, it was like we were just starting the label and we were just kind of figuring out our stuff. I mean, we were literally kids.
If it's your label, would you not like have the number one? Like, if I set up a label, I have a label. I mean, but I don't. Uh-huh. I don't make music because my music sucks balls, and I wouldn't put my own music out. But if I was as good as you and had a label, I'd put myself out as the number one.
Well, I actually was number one, but like Water was number one when I was 13.
Right, okay.
So we were kind of establishing, you know, all our kind of group of friends. And so, yeah, I don't know what number this record was, but this was basically, you know, I thought of my acoustic sort of stuff as like, I don't know, like a side project almost. And this was like my main. I mean, it's like such a stupid name for a band. I don't know what the fuck you're thinking. Some kind of Star Trek thing. I don't know what the fuck was going on. You know,
let me blast in a bit of it now.
Not much worth believing.
That was Commander Venus. Do you feel at home? Not a demo, but probably one of the earliest tracks that are going from Conor Oberst.
Yeah.
Your voice has not broken even remotely. It doesn't even like arrive at the station to travel to Puberty Town. Like.
So yeah, that was going to be the end of my story. Is that so? We put out the, you know, we like made CDs, which at the time was like a big deal. We couldn't afford to make vinyl, obviously, but we were like, we made CDs. We were selling them at our local shows. We were playing. I mean, we even went down and, you know, this is like, at this point, I'm 14, 15. Like the first time I went to like South by Southwest or like CMJ Music Festival, like we actually like toured. I mean, that sounds crazy. And I think it's crazy that my parents let me do it. But
why did you get away with that? Like, I mean, in America, I've been to South by Southwest, right? And I took a punk band that was on my label there and I couldn't get them in anywhere because they were like 19 or 20. How did you get away with that when you were 14?
I mean, there was a lot of shows. I mean, with that band, yeah, there was a lot of places. I mean, I remember in particular this place, Spaceland in LA, that we played. And yeah, they'd let you walk to the stage, do your set, and then you'd have to walk back outside and you couldn't stay in the bar. So I like spent a lot of time just sitting in the van waiting for the other people to get out, you know, cause I was way younger than everybody else in the band. But yeah, the funny end to the story of, so we put out the record on our own label. We're trying to get people to check it out. And then me and Tim Casher have this great idea, because it was right after Valentine's Day. So we go to, you know, we go to the supermarket and there's all these discounted heart-shaped boxes full of candy, you know, the kind you get it. Mm-hmm. I guess, I don't know if you guys do Valentine's Day over there, but very anyway.
Bad. Like we do it the way British people would do it, like going, yes, I love you very much, yes, okay, very good.
We got a bunch of these like boxes of candies. And then we put the CDs in there and then we wrote these like, you know, love letters to all the labels that we liked. So we, you know, we sent one to like Merge. That. We sent one to like Matador. We sent one to like Sub Pop, whatever, like all the, like the cool, the label, you know, this is like, again, this is early mid 90s. So there's like whatever, like indie labels we thought were cool. Packaged them up. Sent them out. We ended up sending one to this label called, which is now like sadly kind of forgotten, but it was this New York label called Grass Records, which actually had a lot of amazing bands. They had like Brainiac, they had like the Wrens, they had this band Sunbrain that we really loved. They had tons of bands. It was like this band Mousetrap that was like actually from Omaha. That's kind of how we knew about them. But they were just a great, weird, eclectic punk label that existed back then. So we sent one to them. And this woman, Camille, I mean, straight up, like I came home from high school, you know, I'm like maybe I'm a freshman in high school or I'm a sophomore in high school. Anyway, come home from high school one day, there's like a message on the machine. And then the phone rings and this, I pick it up and it's just like the most, you know, kind of New York sounding woman. She's like, you know, is this Connor? And I'm like, yes. I'm like, hi. And she's like, I got your CD. And
it sucks.
Anyway, she
hated it.
Like she like loved it. And, but she thought, she was like 1,000% convinced because we hadn't enclosed any kind of pictures or anything like that. So she was 1,000% convinced that I was like a 18-year-old female singing.
Oh shit.
Like, yeah. And when I told her that I was like a 14-year-old boy, she screamed. I remember she screamed. She like said, she was like, what the, like, just like yells. And then she like gets back on the phone and she's like, oh my God, You know, and they signed us. Like, we got a record deal.
Wow.
And yeah, they bought us, like, you know, we did like 2 records with them. They bought us, you know, new amps and like a van and sent us on tour. She ended up, you know, she's, I actually don't know what's up with Camille. I'd love to find her. Camille, if you're out there, find me.
You didn't have much of a, like, a growing period, or, like, you know, you didn't have a bit of, like, too much of that, like, early struggle. Like, you were kind of, like, were getting signed to the labels and having people work with you from the very beginning. That's super rare.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting. I mean, I would say that they were kind of, you know, I mean, they did their best, but they, you know, it wasn't exactly like signing to, like, you know, whatever, Universal. Yeah,
I run a DIY label, and if you look at the size of this room, this is basically, it's like headquarters.
Totally. So they were interesting. They had an office and stuff, but yeah, they were pretty like running low grade, like indie rock stuff. And then at the same time, we were trying to build our own label, you know, the Saddle Creek stuff and all the bands from the town. So eventually we ended up, like, by the time I started Bright Eyes, it was, you know, we were ready to move everything over to like our own label, because we realized that they really weren't, you know, they were trying, but they really weren't helping us out as much as
probably
they should, you know, or whatever. So
you probably wanted that freedom as well. But if you were like doing this all so young, a lot of it must have hinged on your older brothers or older friends, like, because you don't get as good as you were at 13, like, out of the blue. Like, you don't get a guitar for your 12th birthday and just become that good straight away. Like, you must have been like a student from very early doors.
Yeah. So, like I was saying, my oldest brother, Maddie, was a musician, and my dad is a musician. So I was very lucky to have, you know, just around the house, there was guitars and there was, you know, there was a piano, and there was, my dad played saxophone, and, you know, we had like a little kind of like little PA in the basement, you know, that my brother's band would practice on. So music was like very much in the house. I think I was about 10 years old when I, you know, kind of expressed interest in it. And so, you know, I never had formal music lessons, but yeah, my dad and my brother would like just show me chords, like, here's how to play a D chord. And, you know, I remember, I don't know, I think like I learned like Blowing in the Wind or something, you know, like whatever chords were, or whatever songs were like 3 chords. I remember, I was actually telling this story for another interview the other day, but yeah, my brother showed me how to play Here Comes the Regular by The Replacements when I was like 10 or 11 years old, which is like a pretty fucked up song for like a little kid to be singing. But
this is what I think, like, right? I think it should be against the law to play any kid under the age of like 13 Elliott Smith or Radiohead, or like, because like, if you like you're gonna fucking warp some children if you like play them like Elliott Smith when they're 9, like coming to grips with some of those concepts and thoughts.
Yeah,
actually, I mean, you know what, if I have kids, I'm not playing your music to them either, like, until they're too.
I know, I've had that experience a few times where, like, I mean, it's very sweet, but like people will come to a concert, you know, and they'll bring their little kid, which is great, like happy, and, you know, get to say hi or whatever, and then you know, the mom is like, oh, like my little son here, my little daughter, like, loves your music and she wants to hear it all the time. I'm just like, what are you doing? Yeah, like we're like child services, like
there's one children. Song that does work. I could imagine like kids running around singing I don't want to die in the hospital, I don't want to die in the hospital, I don't want to die in the hospital, I want to go outside. Like, kind of fits,
yeah,
a nursery. I mean,
that one's kind of fun, yeah.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I saw that you like were in the school choir for a bit. Like, was that like to get out of lessons? Was that because you genuinely had an interest in singing, or is it because your mom was a teacher and it would make you look good to her?
I was in the school choir.
It says on your Wikipedia. Yeah, I read it earlier.
Oh, absolutely not true.
I was gonna think like after listening to like your music for such a long time. And especially the early stuff that you did as well. None of us too classically trained. You know what I mean?
I don't know. I love that somebody wrote that. I mean, Wikipedia is hilarious. Like, I would say like 95 of my Wikipedia is like not true. But that's funny that someone said that. I will say I was maybe like slightly surprising is that it was never like musical theater, but there was this place called Emmy Gifford's Children's Theater here in town. So when I was, I don't know how old I was young, you know, yeah, probably around the same time, actually probably a little bit before it. Cause I remember like having to give up. I felt like I had to give up my acting career for my music career, but no, they would have these like little, you basically, you'd go, like, it'd be, like, the summertime, you would go take a class, essentially, and then, like, at the end of the class, you know, after, like, 4 weeks or whatever, then you get to, like, put on a play with your friends, so, or with all the kids in the class, so, you know, I did, like, I don't know, like, Peter Pan and, like, The Hobbit, sorry, what's it called?
The Hobbit sounds like a better one, like, there's a load of, like, people from, like, little hobbits from Middle Earth that are addicted to crap.
That was a darker one. Like, Tales of the Arabian Nights, like, that kind of shit, you know? So I remember doing that for a few summers and, like, liking the feeling of being like, you know, like in a theater, like, because it was
on stage as well.
Yeah, it was like a real theater, you know. It's like they had the lights and they had the props, and you know, you had to learn your lines, and it was exciting. Like, I really enjoyed that. So I guess that's not quite like being in the choir, but that was probably the closest to like a
it's still kind of lame, like the choir though. Like,
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had to, like, I mean, I went to Catholic school, so I had to, I had to sit through, I guess, kind of choir. I had to sing in church. And
did you have proper Catholic school? Because, like, I went to Catholic school as well, and we actually had brothers, like, in dog collars, like, teaching us. I mean, I think I was, like, the last year of them, and they were, like, 80-year-old guys who, like, would, like, hit you with a ruler and shit like that.
Yes, I went to Catholic school from, you know, first grade through like high school. In like high school, I went to like an all boy Jesuit high school. So
yeah, same here. Like mine was quite jockey. It was all about like football and stuff like that.
Exactly. And like when I was young, I was like an altar boy. I actually had like this, like, I had this like repressed memory. Like I was telling Phoebe this story the other day, because I was like, I literally like didn't like weird shit happens to you when you're a kid. Hmm. And like, I didn't remember this, but it kind of came back to me. Like, I mean, I was never officially like abused by a priest, but I remember like when you would get dressed for, you know, to put on the shit to be the altar boy on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I remember this, like, you know, and you had to like, it's so fucked up. Like you had to like help like dress the priest, which is like,
yeah, I actually remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, why are you, why is it like a, you know, a fucking 9-year-old boy like dressing like a grown man in like a weird room in the back of the church? It's like super fucked up. But I just remember him kind of like, I like once I, whatever I had to do, like put his like shawl on him. And I remember him like, he kind of hugged me, but I was like, so, you know, I'm so short that like literally like he like presses my face like against his fucking dick. And I was just like, it was like a memory I'd never thought about like in so long, but I like it, like it came back to me. I was just like, what the fuck? Like no wonder this, like big shocker that like this kind of shit was happening. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I personally never had to like go through like a really traumatic thing, but even that memory, I was like, that's kind of weird, man.
Big time. Like, I wanted to be an altar boy, and I did the tryout thing of the day where you go and like, and I didn't find out till years later that like she just went and put a like stop to it before I even started. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you don't even sort of mess with stuff like that.
Right.
Around about the time you were like a teenager, like what sort of bands were you putting posters off on your wall? Like, who were you obsessed with? Like who could you not live without? Like, whose cassettes were you like ramping up every day?
Okay. Well, kind of like a little group of sections. I would say the first stuff that I was lucky to have parents that, you know, were pushing, you know, Paul Simon and Joni Mitchell and, you know, Jackson Brown and, you know, Bob Dylan, all that 70s kind of 60s stuff. My parents loved that. So that was probably my earliest experience with music. And then my brothers were really into like, did you guys have 120 minutes over there? Do you know what that show is?
No, I never heard.
Okay, of that. Anyway, like in the 80s, there was a show on MTV. Like back when MTV just only played videos, there was a show called 120 Minutes on Sunday nights, like at like 10 p.m. And I remember my brother, like his friends would come over and they would like, you know, they would put every, like religiously every Sunday night, they would put the, you know, VHS tape in the recorder and they'd like press record. And it was always, it was basically like all like alternative music or like quote unquote like college rock. So,
yeah,
you know, we're talking REM, The Smiths, The Cure, The Replacements, you know, blah, 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 like that era, The Pixies.
Dinosaur Jr., Sabato, thing like that, yeah.
I mean, yeah, that might even, yeah, probably a little bit. That might even been a little later, but like, yeah, this first era, I mean, I remember falling in love. Like, I love The Cure. It was, like, one of my favorite bands ever.
The first festival I ever went to, I saw The Cure play. And all my friends went to go see The Darkness. And have you heard of them?
The Darkness? Oh, I remember The Darkness, yeah.
So, like, I remember, like, really, really vividly, on the second stage, it was The Darkness. And on the main stage, it was The Cure. And I only knew one Cure song. But I knew I was hell bent on not fucking seeing the darkness. So I was like, I went and watched The Cure by myself. And Robert Smith came out before they even hit a note for 15 minutes and just stood at the front of the stage, just staring out people. And I was like, this fat goth dude is freaking me out. I love it. This is amazing. Do you know I'm up for this?
I mean, yeah. I mean, that guy's written more like perfect pop songs than like anybody.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, he's like amazing.
Have you ever met him?
I have never met him. I've actually weirdly exchanged like some emails with him. And there was like a minute where we were supposed to do some shows with him. I forget what happened, but I've never had the opportunity, but
That's a collab I'd love to see here.
Be like, Robert, if you're out there, you call me up, brother. I'm here. I'm just gonna keep shouting out to people. But then I would say like by the time I was a teenager, it was like we were kind of getting into more like I don't know, I don't wanna say like militant, but we were getting into like deeper like sort of indie rock kind of stuff. So it was like a lot of like Pavement, like Superchunk, you know, Fugazi.
This is purist stuff you're getting into now. This is like, you know,
yeah,
Tattoo like kind of vibes.
Like, yeah, that would be like my high school. And then also, but also weirdly, because we had, like I said, we had this one cool record store in town. So I was kind of simultaneously getting into that, but I was also getting into like more like retro albums. So I was, you know, I was discovering like Townes Van Zandt. I was discovering like John Prine. I was discovering like all these old albums that I think really actually shaped my world more. You know,
like traditionally, you really get into that sort of stuff when you're a bit older as well. So, like, that kind of gave you a bit of a head start. Like, I grew up, like, you know, I was born in like 86, and I grew up watching American TV the whole way through, and still do. And I have this idea of like 97 in America, like, and it's so Disney narrative in my head of there being jocks and there being freaks and there being goths and there being sluts and there being weirdos and there being freaks. Like, how true to life was that? Or was it just like, it was just very, some sort of gray?
Well, I mean, I would say there was, you know, certainly in my high school experience, there was definitely jocks. There was definitely like, kind of football and like not your football, our football, like that kind of shit. And like, you know, I remember like my thing with high school is my parents would like kind of let me do anything as far as like with my bands or like, you know, going on a trip to play a show. It was always like if my grades were good enough, if I had good grades, they would like leave me alone.
Yeah.
And I really, I had like zero friends in high school. I probably had like three friends in my whole high school. I had other friends, but they were all like, they went to other high schools or I knew them through like playing with bands or they're older than me. So it's not like I didn't have friends, but anyway, my high school experience was like, I would try to be as invisible as, you know, possible. So I would just like walk along, you know, walk by the lockers, and I would go to class, and I would always get really good grades. And then when I got off school, I would go play with my bands or play with my friends that played music or go to shows or all that stuff. So I kind of knew I had to keep my grades up to like do all that stuff. So I wasn't really rebellious in that sense. I was pretty straight laced.
In all of the myriad of bands that you had, like in, because like there's a list, and if I like sort of like look at it like upright, if I got it here, yeah. The Magnetas, Park Avenue, Commander Venus, The Faint, Bright Eyes. It's the mid 90s band rush. Did you know Bright Eyes was going to be the one that would sort of go ahead and do most out of it, or was like, did you have any idea?
No, I mean, like I said, like Commander Venus was like the main focus because, well, A, we got a record deal, so we were ecstatic that some label in New York signed us, you know, and like gave us, I mean, they didn't give us a lot of money, but they gave us enough money to like buy some new amplifiers and like get a van. So we were like over the moon. We're like, we've hit the jackpot here. And so Bright Eyes really started the first record, like while I was trying to, or while we were trying to make the second Commander Venus record, which by the way is horrible. Don't listen to it. I like the first one because like my voice is still like, you know, still fucked up, you know, adolescent. And I think it's like kind of cute. And like we sound like the, you know, we like we're trying to sound like the Pixies and stuff. But the second record, which is called Uneventful Vacation, I don't recommend it because it's literally when my voice was changing in the worst way. It was like I was like 16 or something. And it's like breaking in like not a fun way, like not a cool way. And
you've had people come at you before though for early Bright Eyes stuff for like doing that raspy style singing, does this double it up?
It probably coincides somewhat time wise with that, but this shit's bad. It's like it was also kind of the height of like you know what I would call like, I mean we didn't even know it was called like emo at the time, but it was like Midwestern emo. Like there's like a lot of bands that like you probably no one's probably heard of, but these, you know, there's these bands like Vitreous Humor and like, you know, I don't know, Giant's Chair, Mineral, like there's all these like kind of forgotten bands from like the mid-90s Midwest like hardcore emo scene or whatever. Yeah. And that's what we were trying to do, so we were like we were playing really heavy and we were screaming and like, anyway, don't listen to the record. It's not good.
You know I'm going. Like
but on the side of that, I was also making these little folk recordings, like just on my four track. And so the very first Bright Eyes record is a compilation of all these recordings that I made over like 2 years. And it's really, it's not in any way, I also don't recommend listening to that, but like it's not representative in any way of like what the band would eventually sound like. And then so I always consider, even though that's technically the first record, I always consider the second record, which is called Letting Off the Happiness, because that was the first record that I hooked up with Mike Mogis and we recorded it in like, well, I shouldn't say in real studios, we still recorded it in my parents' basement and this other studio in Athens, Georgia. But anyway, it was, I feel like Letting Off the Happiness is like the start of what Bright Eyes is as a band.
That's so like good first, to know, because like, yeah. when I like talk about like say TV shows or albums, like I always suggest people to start at places like say like The American Office. I always tell them to start at season 2 or season 3 because the first season's shit. And with some bands, like I'll like tell them to like say if I was like telling somebody to go back and start Kendrick Lamar, say I'd say like start Good Kid, Mad City, because I'm not really a fan of the previous two. It's nice to know that we can just like we'll just wipe out the first Bright Eyes record there and start the second one.
Yeah, the first Bright Eyes record has really nothing to do with anything. I mean, other than it's me singing and playing guitar, but it's me like literally in my basement with my four track, and it doesn't really make any sense with the rest of the albums, but. And I mean, still, like, there's a lot of embarrassing. Well, there's a lot of embarrassing things on all of the Bright Eyes albums, kind of to me. But like, I would say that's like the first real record because that was the first record that you know Michael got involved with, and then we made Fevers and Mirrors, and then in 2002 we made Lifted, which was the first one that Nate Walcott got involved with, who went on to like, you know, everything after that, it was always like the three of us. Mm-hmm. And now more than ever, like especially with the new record, it's like it's very much the three of us. Like everyone gets equal input, everyone's ideas are we have to all three be like equally happy with it. So
has anything changed like over the years, like the way that you approach music? Because obviously, like since putting out the last record, there's been a long period of like obviously not working together. Obviously, you're still friends and stuff, and you never broke up as a band. But stepping into a studio with somebody, is it like picking it up just as it was beforehand, or is it like, you know, people have learned stuff, they got different approaches, or using Brian Eno's oblique strategies and shit?
We do have that in our studio. But no, I think for us, it was pretty much picking up where we left off. I mean, I think that we all learned things obviously over the last, 9 years or whatever it was. And I think every project, or at least, hopefully every project or collaboration, you gather a little more information, and there are things you can take with you. I mean, it's not always, it's not always on like the surface level of your brain, and some of this stuff just kind of subconsciously. But I think that we all learned some things. And I think the biggest the newest development with this record compared to the other records is, in the past, I would, not all the time, but most of the time, I would bring sort of finished songs and I would present them to the guys, and then they would help arrange them and we'd decide on production ideas and all that. But for this one, we spent 2 years making the record, but the first year was just demoing and writing. So a lot of the songs on the new album are musical ideas that either Nate or Michael would give to me. Then I would kind of live with them. I would try to come up with a vocal melody or a vocal melody lyrics that fit with what they were doing. And I'd kind of rearrange that, rearrange it on the computer. And like, it was kind of like building blocks. It was much more, it took a lot longer, I'll say that.
Yeah.
But I think it came out cooler because, it just, those guys are, when I write a song, it's like really, it's like I'm basically like a folk singer. It's like pretty much like cowboy chords kind of shit. a lot of C's and G's and A minors,
Some chicken mash up in front of you.
But those guys are like, Nate's like an amazing composer. They write for like film and TV all the time. And, Nate went to music school. He's like he played jazz like most of his life before he got into rock and roll. And then Michael can like, you literally could put anything with like strings on it, like in his hands, and he'll play it like beautifully. Like they're just musically, they're much more sophisticated than I am. So to kind of start some songs with their musical concepts and then build from there was interesting. And it was different than we'd done on, our other albums.
That's good though. Like great bands are the ones that complement each other, where somebody does something that the other one can't. Like I'd imagine they can't write the psychotic rhyme that you can when it comes to the lyrics. I don't know whether to go into like the live or the lyrics. I've always been sort of I've always loved your lyrics, like because there's so much depth and narrative to them, and then you'll throw in like a phrase where you've never seen. Almost every song you've got, there'll be two words that have never been put together in a song before, which I quite like. Like it doesn't feel like you're treading over old ground.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I try. I think that the vocal melodies. I play guitar and I play piano, but I don't, you're never going to catch me taking like a 10-minute guitar solo. You're never going to, like, I just don't, I'm not like a musician in that way. Like I always play. The only reason I play the instruments is so that I can write the songs mm-hmm. and perform them. So, yeah, I don't know. I just don't being like some kind of virtuoso or it's just not really that much of interest to me, but writing like vocal melodies that are catchy and interesting. And even though I have a fucked up voice, like trying to use it as best as I can. And like, I love singing. I love screaming. I love all the elements of that. Like that's kind of like my musicality. And then, but I guess my real, you know, my most real kind of passion is, you know, writing the words and coming up with things that are interesting to hear, because that's a lot of the music that you know, the music that's
you take a lot of inspiration from what you're reading at the time and where you're out and about, like in people's conversations that you're having, right?
Yeah, I think like, you know, to me it's always kind of like picking up little pieces, you know. I always think of it as like, you know, you're walking around every day and you might hear just a snippet of someone's conversation that like piques your ears. And then if you can remember that little phrase, or yeah, you're reading something or you're watching a movie or you're whatever, there's like there'll be some little thing that like will stick in my brain. And I try to like, you know, collect those as I go around. And then I don't quite know how they like will come out in a song. You know, it's not like there's nothing very like mathematic about it. It's very much.
It's just creativity, really. It's flow.
Yeah. It's like still like a mystery to me, which I actually appreciate. Like, I'm glad that like the mystery's not gone. You know, I know that like if I have like a life experience or I see something in life that affects me, it's not gonna come out in a song the next day. It's gonna come out in a song probably 3 years from then, you know?
Wow.
And I'll have like totally forgotten about it. Like it'll be living in like the little storage room in my brain. And then like someday, like, you know, whatever that stuff, magical stuff in my head, it'll bring up that, you know, it'll bring up that old box like out of the basement, and it'll like set it there and it'll be like, remember how that felt.
That also sounds quite harrowing, because it feels like I have to relive some shit like quite all the time, like, but I mean, we all have it, like it's the equivalent of going to bed and going, I'm gonna have a real nice night's sleep tonight, and then remembering something you did from 9 years ago and sitting there wide-eyed open freaking out for an hour.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I was thinking, right, like how many albums have you been attached to in terms of like how many have you written and been on at this stage? This has just come to me now.
Whoa.
Because like it must be a lot. Like there mustn't have been a 2-year period where you haven't released something or been a part of something.
I mean, we'd definitely have to count them up. I mean, I think there's, you know, there's 10, I think there's like 10 or so Bright Eyes records, not to mention like EPs and shit. And then there's, you know, probably 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's probably like 6 solo albums. There's 2 Desparcidos albums.
16, 16. Yeah, I mean,
the album with Phoebe. And there's the album with Monsters of Folk. I don't know, man. It's like
crazy numbers.
Been on a lot of albums.
What's your favorite solo record? I can't pick my favorite Bright Eyes record because I've got a couple, but I know really solidly which my favorite solo record is, because it's like a complete record.
Shit. I don't know. I mean, I don't feel like it's like a popular opinion, but I feel like I'm pretty proud of the last little run of records because, you know, in 2014, I made Upside Down Mountain and worked on that record really hard. I had just signed to like this label, Nonesuch, and I was like, I was essentially trying to make like my, I don't know, like here I am, like Paul Simon, like classic, like, you know, that record's got kind of slick, but it's, I think it's actually like a pretty dope record if you like listen to it. And then I made Payola with Desaparecidos in like 2015, which was, you know, like the most overtly political record I ever made. Like, you know, we signed Epitaph and it was like just, you know, kind of straight to the bloodstream pop punk political music, and no one gave a shit. Literally, like no one cared.
That record kind of fucked you up a little bit though, that wasn't it? Like, because that record was the one where you had to stop the tour because you had like laryngitis and anxiety and exhaustion and things like that.
Yeah. Turns out it's hard to play that level of like energy every night. I mean, I can't blame it all on that, but yeah, that kind of sidelined me. And then the next record I made was myself at a piano with a harmonica, you know, Ruminations, which was like totally like not even supposed to be a record. It was just, I mean, talk about like polar opposite of the Desaparecido situation. Just couldn't be more different. It was like me like alone literally in this room playing this piano over here. Nice. And then I got to make Citations, which was like so fun, or so it's very fun for me because I got to have the Felice Brothers, which are like my favorite band. And I got to have Jim Keltner, who's like the most classic drummer who like produced it with me. And that was like, I don't think people really cared about that record either, but like, to me, that was like,
I doubt it, man. Like that record was good. Like I liked that one.
That one made me happy because I was like getting to play with like all my favorite musicians. And then, you know, doing the Better Oblivion stuff with Phoebe was the next thing, which was like totally kind of out of left field. But, you know, that was super magical, just, you know, because I love her so much and she's such a great songwriter. And that was like a totally new experience that I didn't see coming, really.
It's
so
super sweet, like seeing it as well, yeah. Because like the shared respect that you can see on stage and you can hear on record, mm-hmm. is like, you can hear your songwriting in Phoebe's first album and you can tell that you've been an influence on her, but like you can also see how much energy that she gives you as well. Like, so like there's this like perfect 50-50 balance in the group.
Totally. I mean, you know, she's one of my best friends in the whole world. And
Did she ever tell you the story about the time she shat herself on stage in London? That was my club night. She told me that. She told me that, and I had no idea on the night. I had no idea until she told me. She told me a couple of months ago. And I think I sat in my kitchen, like, after the podcast had finished, like, I'd had PTSD. I was looking off into the distance, like, I can't believe Phoebe Bridgers shat herself on the night.
She has told me that story. Hey. Happens to the best of us, you know, sometimes.
Have you shot yourself on the stage at any point in the...
I have been, like, I probably have, like, you know, I'd have to, like, circle back with her and see, you know, what level we're talking about. But I've definitely, like, shat myself a little bit. And
just a nugget.
I've definitely, like, thrown up behind the amps, and I've had to like run off stage to like be sick or like find a restroom. I mean, it just happens. It's like there's a lot of sometimes like when you're traveling, you're not that healthy, you're kind of nervous, you know, a lot of stuff can go down. So
if you're on stage for two hours a night, that's a 1/12 of the day that you have to be not sick on stage for. That's quite
right. It's like no shame in that game.
No shame at all. So like we got the Bright Eyes record. It's coming out like very, very soon. Friday, yeah. Man, all the best with it. Like seriously, like I'm absolutely stoked that Bright Eyes are back releasing music, and I'm just following like a little musical disciple of whatever shit you decide to drop next. Like so, like yeah, whatever poker record it is that you've got coming in 2021, I'll be there.
Cool. Well, I got my only last question for you, Philip, is like, do you think I'm an asshole?
No, I definitely don't think you're an asshole. Do you think I'm an asshole?
No, I think you're lovely. I think you're a beautiful man. All right. Bap.
Fist bump.
All right. All right.
You've made my day, Connor. Have a good rest of the day and good luck with the record on Friday.
All right. Love you, buddy. You get some sleep. All right.
Cheers, man.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Peace.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.